Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
In this case, it was actually a dear friend of mine, Frank Recchia of News 12 Connecticut, who I worked with for a couple of years while I was at News 12. He actually knew this story before anyone else did. He broke the news back in December, the tragic death of Lauren Smithfields, a 23-year-old, beautiful, successful woman who was just getting her life started, tragically died back in December. And there are a lot of gaps in this story, and there were a lot of... as people are saying, a lot of balls were dropped by the Bridgeport Police Department. And even over the weekend, Mayor Joe Ganim, expressing his disappointment in the department, has now removed, I should say, put two people on leave this morning, and another officer who was retiring, I guess he had to retire, this past Friday because of how this case and another very eerily similar to Lauren's was handled in the city of Bridgeport. This morning, we are checking in with Darnell Crossland. He is the attorney representing Lauren's family of Crossland Law Group out of Stamford, Connecticut. Good morning, Darnell. Good to connect with you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Darnell, first of all, where are we at with Lauren's case? What I find interesting about this is that she passed away in December, and more than a month later, it took us that much time to get autopsy results and to open a criminal investigation into her death.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And I think where we are now is a place where we're happy that the people most close to us are hearing us. Since the time Lauren died, people from around the world, as far as Hawaii, has reached out to us. We hadn't heard anything from the city in which Lauren lived. We haven't heard anything from the mayor's office. We heard anything from the police department. And we were just totally discarded. So with the fact that it's now a criminal investigation, with the fact that the mayor has now accepted liability for the behaviors of the police department, we feel that the people most close to us are finally hearing us. And so that breeds a little bit of hope for the direction we're heading in.
Darnell, when you heard about the same day that Lauren passed, a 53-year-old woman also passed under very mysterious circumstances after going on a date with somebody she had just met as well. Again, very eerily similar to Lauren's case. Were you shocked by it, the fact that that family was also mishandled by police? They were not informed that the woman they love as well, that she had passed away?
Yeah, I actually wasn't. That family came into my office and sat with me, the entire family. They were sincere. And we were having a march for Lauren the following day. And so I said, you guys have to come out and tell your story. And they came out and did just that. And what I find shocking was that when they explained their story, they went to the Bridgeport Police Department. They were given the wrong detective's name. They finally found the right detective. When they called him, he basically turned his backs on them. They wanted to get Ms. Rawls' clothing and property, and they were given a runaround. And they were told to stand in the police lobby as though they were trash. And we just can't have that. It just makes no sense to me.
Darnell, how long have you been an attorney?
17 years.
Have you ever seen this happen where families were, first of all, not even informed of a death, but then also treated the way that these two families have been treated?
No, it's not the normal. Because what normally happens is that even the media cannot get really much information until the next of kin is notified. That whole idea of notification to the next of kin is paramount. And it's respected across the world. In this particular case, they just scoop these women up, send them off to Potter's Field or to the morgue, and just dust their hands and kept it moving. And with no, so these families had to find out about their family members dying in the probably the media or on the streets or in other ways that are just not respectful. And that's not normal.
Why do you think that happened then?
Well, I think it's a level of two things, or a combination of two things. It's a combination of incompetence and a combination of racial insensitivity. I think that what we're seeing across the country is if you have the missing white woman syndrome in effect, the Gabby Petito, if you would, which kind of reminds us of this syndrome, I think, which goes back to 1977, all the major outlets were reporting on this missing white woman syndrome. when Gabby Petito died. So I'm not making this up. So when you have a combination of incompetence and a little bit of that, you end up with a disregard for people of color who die under these circumstances in predominantly Black and Latino cities such as Bridgeport. And we just not going to have it. I don't think it matters what city you're in or what color your skin is. You should be treated with protocol. And we can keep going about how protocol is broken with, in fact, that they did not secure the scene. They did not care about materials of evidentiary value, such as a condom with semen in it. When the gentleman who was not even arrested, the gentleman that was questioned was said that they never had sex and he slept with his clothes on. Yet still, they don't compare that to the physical evidence that's present. That's just a total disregard for law enforcement.
Darnell, I'm curious. We're talking to attorney Darnell Crossland. He's representing the family of Lauren Smith Fields. Do you believe if Lauren was white, this would have been handled differently?
It's so much of, I'm shocked. When I listen to the question, I almost want to scream, hell yeah, because it's shown us that. We've seen that. And what I could imagine in my mind, because I've been doing this for so long, is that if this was a 23-year-old white girl from Fairfield University laying dead in an apartment, and this was a guy, a Black guy from Boston Avenue in Bridgeport, he will still be sitting at the police station getting his DNA swabbed. It would sound like, listen, Leroy, don't worry. You're going to go home soon. We're going to help you out. We just want to take your buccal swab so we can just kind of compare to this condom we found. You're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. And if you need a reference point for those people who love to say, oh, that's just the race card. If you need a reference point, you can go back as far as Emmett Till, or you can look at the Central Park Five, where these little boys were held and harassed and yelled at and screamed at by the police and forced to confess to a Connecticut resident who was brutally beaten by a guy who later confessed that he did it. You remember that?
How eerie that is?
That was a Connecticut resident.
Yeah, and I watched the documentary on it. If people haven't watched it, it's very bone-chilling. Yes. Yes, of course.
The documentary is when they see us.
Yep.
And so when they see us, they treat us that way. So for all those idiots out there who wants to say, oh, he's playing the race card, or oh, the race card, just look at your historical references and ask yourself, is this the America that we want? Or can we have some equality in process? That's all. There's so many reference parts. Way back as Emmett Till, again, as a Central Park Five, and a Connecticut resident was a victim in that. And she found out through a confession that it wasn't even these five boys whose lives have been ruined. So to answer your question, it would be much different if it was a white girl from Fairfield University or one of the suburbs and a Black kid from Boston Avenue, Bridgeport.
We're chatting this morning with attorney Darnell Crossland. Darnell is representing the family of Lauren Smith Fields, the 23-year-old woman who tragically died in her apartment back in December. And her death has been a mystery. It was up until about a week ago when we saw an autopsy report saying that alcohol and a number of drugs, including fentanyl, were in her system. Darnell, what is her family saying at this point? Could she have possibly just had a very wild binge drinking party night? Or was that not Lauren character?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the mother is adamant, the family is adamant that she was a type of woman that wakes up every morning, goes to LA Fitness to work out. She was very much into her fitness routine, her health regimen in terms of what she drank and how she ate. As you can see from her Facebook and Instagram, she was all about just life and living it and looking beautiful. And the experts are saying once you look at what was found in her body, aside from the fentanyl or in addition to the fentanyl, they were antihistamines. And those things are pretty much substances that make you sleepy, make you drowsy. And if Lauren was on a date and it's the first time meeting this guy, the last thing somebody would want to do is take something to make them sleepy or drowsy. However, the first thing a predator would want to do is to make you sleepy or drowsy. So those are, according to the experts that I've been talking to, are commonly associated with date rape drugs, those type of antihistamines. So, the facts look that way.
That's what I was going to suggest. So at this point, are you having a strong opinion? Of course, it's early in the investigation. I understand that you also can't compromise it, but I have to ask the question. So do you believe that Lauren was date raped? And unfortunately, because there could have been fentanyl, or there was fentanyl included, that could have killed her? I mean, we're seeing fentanyl deaths, unfortunately, across Connecticut right now. So do you believe at this point that's your strong indication of what might have happened?
Yes. You know, I can tell you as an experienced attorney, and I have a case now that broke about 3 months ago up in Middletown area where a little baby was found dead. And when we got the autopsy back, it turns out that it was a fentanyl death. Mm-hmm. And the baby was about 3 years old. So we know this child doesn't use fentanyl. So as investigation developed, it turns out that someone in the house was using fentanyl or been around it. And the little baby touched the coffee table, put his hand in his mouth, and he died.
Oh,
so we know that fentanyl is that powerful, and even the slightest exposure. What about the school with the kids who were exposed to fentanyl recently here in Connecticut?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, they had to quarantine the whole area. The teachers mm-hmm. were locked in a room, and they treated the place as a hazmat area. Mm-hmm. So we know fentanyl is that powerful. In this particular case, the idea here is that the mother feels as though her daughter was drugged mm-hmm. and raped, and she deserves to have a proper investigation. So we shouldn't have to guess. The police should have already said, as experts have said, treated this area like a homicide and dial it back if they need to. You don't treat it the other way and then dial it up. And so when the government, the mayor's office, et cetera, was saying we're waiting for the autopsy, that's not the way you do this. The autopsy can only tell you the cause of death and manner of death.
I was going to say, in your professional opinion, how often do police departments wait for autopsy results to finally open up a criminal investigation?
Never.
Yeah, I never heard of that either. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. All you could, like I said, you don't need an autopsy to tell you how to be exercise a bit of humanity. You just exercise that humanity. You reach out to the next of kin. You do an investigation. You tell these family members no one is to come into this apartment because it's a crime scene at this point. But instead of that, they let the family members come in. They let them start moving Lauren's stuff, and they compromise the area. And then the detectives who have been removed then tells them, hey, by the way, since you were all over the crime scene, we need to take your DNA. And I'm like, why do you need to take the family's DNA? Their DNA is going to be in the apartment because they've been there many times.
Right, they touched everything. Right, right.
Exactly.
Darnell, really quick, because I know we're running out of time, what about the man who she went on a date with? I know he's cooperating. I feel very strongly, but maybe I'm hallucinating. Has he been reported on before? Have other women complained about this man before? Or did I make that up?
No, well, just this week, I just got into my office on Friday after shooting Access Hollywood, got into my office, and there's a note on the desk for a woman who says to call her, and because she has information about this guy. I decided to call Court TV and let them call her. They called her, and she sent them a picture of herself, and they got back on the phone with me and says, Darnell, that was eerie. I said, what happened? They said the woman reported that when she saw his face, she had a panic attack. Because she remembered one night that she drove into a gas station, he followed her in, and he wouldn't stop staring at her. And she was so afraid, she pulled off, he followed her, then he pulled up against her again, and she called her mother and tried to get his license plate, but she did not. And she said when she saw it on the news, she just freaked out. So these are the things that we're hearing. And so no one is saying that this man doesn't have a right to a defense. All we're saying is that the police should treat this person as a person of interest, and our investigators are collecting statements from people like this woman. And so that's what it is, just a journey to justice, and we just want the truth.
Well, Darnell Crossland, again, attorney representing Lauren Smithfield's family, we thank you so much for coming on. We'd love to have you back on the show whenever things develop or whenever possible. We'd love to have you back on the show, and I thank you for your time.
Get me back on once we break 0 degrees.
Yeah, seriously. It is very cold out there. Darnell, thank you so much, and appreciate your time this morning and for the work you're doing for Lauren's family. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's a little confusing out there because if you read divorce statistics, we actually are seeing a decrease nationally. That is true. We are nationally seeing a decrease in divorces. However, ironically enough, we are also seeing in recent years less and less people getting married. So it's one of those facts that is kind of hard to feel concrete about because there are plenty of people who have been legally together for many, many years. They share children together. They are living together. They're in serious long-term relationships together, but they never put a ring on it. And if they break up, it's not looked at as a divorce. That's not to say that we don't have issues with having very healthy marriages or unions even. So we're doing a two-part series talking about affairs. As we learned last week from Bob Donovan, one of the three biggest reasons why a marriage doesn't work is because someone had an affair. So we're tackling that in our second part this morning with Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing today? I'm ready for today. Myself.
Yes, I am ready as well. Yeah, I want to see how much of this we can really dive into, because last week we ran out of time and we really talked about how does a spouse overcome if their spouse cheats on them. And one of the things we really focused on was what the cheater has to do, essentially. What do they have to do to earn the person's trust back? And we couldn't really dive into the other side, which was, you know, how do we overcome this? How, if we are the victims in the situation, how do we overcome this? So I guess I wanted to kind of open up the floor to you and have you sort of start the conversation and tell us, where do we go from here?
Yeah, I wish I didn't have the experience of this, but I do. That's a good word, the victim in this. Really hard, really, really hard, because it's complicated, it's painful, often it's layered. So when I get involved with this, and usually it's early on after they found something out, and the first thing that I try to just convey is they have to just grieve. They have to grieve that not to enter into any decisions, don't call a lawyer. Separation might be a possibility right there, but I really try to talk to that couple, the victim, about just allowing your emotions in a healthy way to be expressed, to grieve. They lost their marriage. They really have. Even if they put it back, it's a different marriage. So they have lost something. So there is this grieving process that takes place. And the tension here is that the victim wants to stay there, wants to grieve and feel things, and that's true, and that could take months. The spouse that had the affair, they want to move on.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this tension at this point. Where I try to come in is just talk to them about, take this in 30-day increments. Don't do anything. Don't call a lawyer, but just process the emotions. I can talk more about what that's going to look like, but to really just accept the fact that you lost something, it's painful. They're going to grieve it, and this is necessary way before the healing phase. And that's where, you know, the spouse that had the affair, they want to jump to the healing phase.
Unfortunately, you kind of lost that right to do that. If I do say so myself, yes. And maybe this is where that's coming up short as a Christian. But to me, you know, of course you want to go to the healing stage, but you sort of lost your right to do that because you caused the harm. So you got to
totally
go
right.
Through the, you got to go through the trenches a little bit.
Exactly right. And that's exactly what they've lost, kind of right to. Even the whole, you know, another point is just the spouse, the victim, gets to make some new rules about, you know, access to iPhones and access to emails and possibly putting a tracker on their phone. And like they get to, so the spouse, the victim, kind of has the right to make these decisions. Like, you're right, the spouse that had the affair, they kind of lost up that right. And that's what I mean last night. I talked about if they're truly remorseful, they'll take this on. They'll say, okay, whatever you need. If you need put a tracker on my phone, I'm good. And that's what I mean about, were they truly remorseful?
Mm-hmm.
So these are the early things you try to do in the first 30 days or so, is to, again, help them understand, don't make any rash decisions, allow the grieving process to take place, and process your emotions in a healthy way. I mean, this is a hard one, because some people are emotional, and this is a painful thing, and, you know, sometimes anger gets in the mix here. So, you know, I try to, like, walk them through that to process things in a healthy way.
I'm curious, Bob, you know, in those 30 days, because I too have in my dating years, I'll say, just so everyone's not confused with my actual marriage. In my dating years, I also have unfortunately experienced this happening. And I'm curious, you know, oftentimes, and of course, you know, younger years, you're a little more immature. You would hope by the time you get married that you have matured enough to understand an adult relationship. But oftentimes, when you have been cheated on, the guilt tripping from the person who committed the act sometimes starts where, I understand if you want to leave me. I understand if you don't want to be with me anymore. I understand. And it's actually a horrific feeling, because you feel like you're making it's almost like the ball's back in your court, when you're like, wait a second, hold on, you're jumping the gun right now, and I'm not even getting the opportunity to be sad about this, to make a rational decision, and already you're sort of like throwing in the towel. Would you say for people who are like, hey, you know, if you want to divorce me over this, I understand. Does that speak to the character of the person you're married to? Like, should that be a red flag, or is that just sort of a defense mechanism?
Yeah, it's a defense mechanism.
It is, okay.
Totally. Yeah, I try not to. I really, and again, when this happens and I'm involved, that unfortunately it takes some time, but I'm able to speak into what they should do, their roles, you might say. And this is where that kind of language, I really ask that the spouse that had the affair, just don't go there. Just, and I really try to, whether it's a man or woman, it doesn't really matter, but just really kind of let the victim, let your spouse just grieve. Let them, we're not in the healing. We're not even having that conversation yet. You may, right? You hopefully will. But at this point in time, you're trying to just, you almost like I say, stop the bleeding. Don't make it worse. Don't have discussions that are too premature. Don't get into rationalization. Don't get into any of that. So I try not to have them go there in that conversation. But that truly is a defense mechanism when they throw that out there.
We are chatting with our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan, and we're going through how to overcome an affair to save your marriage. Divorce rates might be down across the U.S. That's true. But also they're showing data that more and more people are not even getting married. They're just having long-term relationships. And they're having kids, and they're living together. They're not even engaging in the sacrament of marriage. And one of the biggest reasons why people break up and get divorced, one of the three biggest reasons, is because somebody had an affair. So we're trying to help, trying to avoid that happening, and understand a little bit of the process of how to do that. So, Bob, you were saying another key factor in overcoming this problem is what?
Yeah, this is a big one, because, again, think about this. When this happens, there's just so much hurt and pain, and there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of talk going on, and whether it's from the victim or the one that had the affair. So what I try to do is, once you get over the initial finding this out, once you get through that, is just to limit the amount of time you talk about this. Because this happened to this one couple especially, and it was just relentless on both parties. It was constant throughout the day. And I said, look, just, you know, pick a time after dinner, whatever, lunchtime, 15, 20, maybe 30, whatever you need, but limit the amount of time you talk about this. That helped them tremendously, because it took something that was consuming them emotionally all day, and it's like they just poured into each other.
But how do you do that? How do you turn it on and off?
Yeah, well, again, first of all, you have to kind of wait to the initial kind
shock.
Of flood of emotion, shock, right, happens. I think, you know, the first, that could be up to 30 days. I mean, each one's different, but you kind of wait for that initial tidal wave of emotions to abate a little bit. All right. And then at that point, it's just not healthy. I mean, even couples that are in this know, I don't want to do, in fact, this couple I was talking about, that's what they said. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to have this consume our conversations all the time. So they typically have exhausted their emotions, and they want to like have some limits on what they talk about. So once you get through the tidal wave, then you can like settle into doing this. That actually works quite well. If you're timing on this whole thing, Melissa, timing is everything. That's why it's so important. Who are you listening to? Like I mentioned, this 30 days. And one of my other points, circle the wagons. Don't tell the world. Don't tell everybody in your family. Don't tell every friend you have. just be really selective on who you're involving in this thing. Because, again, there's a process for this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you another another key fact, really big factor in here for the victim is get all the facts and details, but not too much.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean?
This is a tricky one. Yep. So the victim, again, when this is all out in the open, again, it's open, right? Oh, tell me all about it. Like who, when,
how did it start?
How many times, all that, how did it start? Yeah. How deep you involved, like all that, right? Where I've seen this really get tricky is when they want to know all the details, if you know what I mean. All the physical details.
It's not necessary.
About it, like,
it's not necessary. If you want to save your marriage, it's not necessary.
Well, and here's the hard part, because the victim kind of, I've seen, they do want to know that. They do. They want to know everything. And you need a guided pastor or counselor to lead them through this. Again, as many details as you need to heal, but not too much, because once you kind of know the gory details of everything that happened, you cannot get that out of your mind.
You can't unsee it.
Yeah. So that's a line that you got to come right up to that line. Like, whatever you need, I'll tell you. But beyond that, do you really need to know that? And that's where, you know, a pastor or a counselor can navigate that line, because that line's different for each person. But that's a big one. That's a big one. Because if you go too far, then it's rough to ever get that out of your mind.
Yeah, it may not be repairable, I would think, at that point. Because you are now looking at your spouse as being only this person.
That's a hard thing.
And we're talking to Bob Donovan this morning. But, here's the elephant in the room, Bob. God doesn't believe in divorce, right? God doesn't like divorce. He likes to see that we're in holy matrimony. But, you know, you see sometimes that people are just not right together. And you find that there are people who, I think this is the hardest, is they stay together for their kids. But they can't, at this point, they can't repair the damage. And they don't even like the person they're married to anymore. So have you ever come to a point in your 15 years of doing this, do you make the recommendation, hey, listen, maybe you focus on yourself as an individual and you don't do this union anymore? You know, like I understand the Bible wants you to stay married. I get that. But sometimes it's almost the worst thing, I would think.
Yeah,
I don't know.
A couple things. Yep, a couple things. One of all, Melissa, I never, ever recommend getting divorced. I never recommend to a couple if they should get married or shouldn't get married. I don't do that. Like, I'll lead them through that process.
But you'll never say the words, you should get divorced or you should be together. Yeah.
I will never say that. That's a personal, intimate decision that each couple has to make. Okay. However, I can lead them into that point so they consider all the indications. Like in this case here, right? These 30-day increments. Well, why these 30-day increments are to decide at some point, and maybe it's 30 days in some case. I have one right now. They found out in May, and they're still kind of in this 30, 45-day increment. I think they're – yeah, each one's different. But they needed that, and I think they're – initially, this was the wife had an affair. The husband wanted a divorce. And I said, so hold this thing off 30 days, 45 days, 30 days. And he's at the – he wanted a divorce, but now – he's thinking of working it out. You see, so these 30-day increments, now, in some cases, it's over. I mean, in some cases, the healing has taken place, but they've decided it is over. Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned, the Bible, and the Bible is clear. This is a biblical reason for couples to get divorced. Adultery is one of the reasons that the Bible does say. However, the Bible also says, right, how many times you forgive?
Right.
Like 7 times 70, right? Mm-hmm. So there's another tension point here. Are they right to do that? Yes. Should they? I don't know. If they go through this process, we'll see. So these are so complicated.
It is complicated, yeah.
The last one I will throw out, I know you're probably pressed on time here, is for the victim. Don't forgive too quickly. Don't forgive too quickly. In some cases, and again, maybe sometimes they're strong Christians, and again, they're reading into the Bible, Jesus asks us to forgive, and they're, well, you know what? I'm going to do that. And they forgive way too quickly before they process all the emotions, and maybe short-term that might be okay, but that will come back to hurt them in the long run. And believe it or not, I have one right now that this happened 2 years ago. And that's what happened, is that he forgave too quickly. He was the victim. And he's kind of still stuck. So that's another one. A pastor or a counselor can lead them through this process to do some things and then not do some things.
Well, Bob, if there are people listening over the last 2 weeks and they're feeling, you know, pulled to talk to someone about their relationship, how can they contact you?
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. B. Donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
Bob, we appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this
long
series.
Yeah. All right.
That's Bob Donovan here on WICC. According to the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, about 20% of all injuries from skiing and snowboarding related injuries are head injuries. Hockey is among the top sports that have the highest number of head injuries, according to injuries treated in the U.S. emergency department. So we're going to talk about this and brain injury prevention, especially ahead of the Winter Olympics. Joining me this morning is Dr. Paul Wright. He's a board-certified neurologist, senior vice president, and system chair of the Nuvance Health Neuroscience Institute. Good morning, Dr. Wright. Thanks for being on the show.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the program.
Absolutely. So it's very fitting, very timely, ahead of the Winter Olympics. First of all, Dr. Wright, even here in Connecticut, we have a number of athletes from football to hockey to, you know, skiing, some of the ones I had mentioned. They, too, I'm sure, have to learn about head injury prevention. What are some of the biggest, would you say, things that you want athletes to know about before they even enter a sport?
Well, I think it's very important nowadays that we're all becoming more aware of the ability to have a head injury with a sport, especially when a contact sport. But I think it's very important that when you start engaging in a sport where there's a potential for sustaining a head injury, that we're, number one, aware of our surroundings, that we really look around us and say, well, do I have the potential to have an impact from an object in my area? Also, we really need to know our abilities in terms of our technique. Are we as good as we think we are? Should we go as fast as we should be going and be more aware? But I think what's very, very important is, as we are all aware that there's potential for a head injury, that we all have helmets. And it's imperative that we wear helmets. But the thing that I think is very important is, just because you're wearing a helmet, it does not mean to say that you're devoid of all injury. They can blunten the response to an injury, but it's important to know that it does not completely remove all potential head injury.
Dr. Wright, what does it actually mean to have a concussion? What does that mean when you have one?
Well, a concussion that usually affects athletes when they have a hit to the head. What's very important, I think, is an important message to get across. It's not only a direct hit to the head, it's also a jolt. So you can injure a different part of the body, and it can actually cause a movement of the head. So essentially, a concussion is a disruption or a result of shaking of the brain within the skull.
Oy. So how long would you say, on average, somebody should be off the field, off the ice, off their bike, whatever it may be? How long should they be resting if they have a concussion on average?
And that's a wonderful question. And what I usually do is, it really comes down to an individualized process, because there's many aspects to sustaining a head injury. And was there loss of consciousness? And if there was loss of consciousness, how long did the loss of consciousness occur? And everybody has a different response. So really, a program of return to play or return to normal activity should really be tailor-made to the individual.
Dr. Paul Wright is here. He's the Senior Vice President and System Chair of the Nuvance Health Neuroscience Institute, and we're talking about traumatic brain injury prevention. So, you know, Dr. Wright, you said that there are, you know, one of the biggest things, wear a helmet, sure. How many concussions would you say a person has to go through or a blow to the head, should I say, how many times would you say it is like too much? You know, for example, if you've got a football player and they've had 10 concussions in their college careers, is that too much? Like, do you ever hit a limit where it's like, hey, you should probably quit that sport? I'm sure each you know, case is individual, but, you know, what would you say is sort of a limit if you had to ballpark?
I would say no more than 2 to 3.
Really?
But again, it all depends on the severity of each concussion. Because when you start developing multiple concussions, then you start saying, well, what's the long-term effect of these multiple concussions? And again, I do want to emphasize it really depends on the severity of each one of these concussions.
And I think the last time we chatted on the air, we were talking about CTE. Weren't we talking about that, Dr. Wright? CTE, the chronic traumatic, the neurodegenerative. Okay, that's what I thought. So is that caused by having too many concussions, or we don't know that just yet?
This is much more severe than just a simple concussion when you have CTE. What happens with CTE is multiple repetitive injuries to the brain. And this goes down to the microscopic level so that when the brain moves, all the nerves and the nerve attachments and connections shear or disrupt, which then if you actually look in the microscopic slide, you'll see hemorrhages, you'll see buildup of abnormal proteins that lead to long-term injury of the brain and subsequent long-term changes in a patient.
But at this point, Dr. Wright, there is no way to do like a brain scan to see if you have CTE, correct?
Correct. At this point, it goes down to the microscopic level.
Mm. So, you know, speaking of prevention, as we wrap up, Dr. Wright, are there other things people can do?
I think it's to use judgment when you're actually participating in a sport, but more so when we talk to the public. It's also about individuals who go out and say, well, I need to shovel the snow, or I need to go up and clean the snow from my roof, and do things that they normally wouldn't do and place themselves in harm that can lead to long-term detriment in terms of head injuries.
Dr. Wright, we so appreciate having you on this show of New Vance Health, a neuroscience institute. Thank you so much for talking about this, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show really soon.
Thank you, and stay safe, everybody.
Thank you. You too.